It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to apples. Let's give a nod to amazing apple orchards and festivals around Wisconsin. Apple cultivars that have been grown here for decades, perhaps centuries. We go outside our state now to find out what makes the Agriculture Department's apple collection the most unique and its mission as a hub for genetic preservation. Join in on keeping different apple species alive. Questions about heirloom apples, wild apples, breeding, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben Gutierrez is a geneticist and the curator of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Apple and Tart Cherry Collections based in Geneva, New York. Ben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is so exciting. I try to not be flattered because I know you're here for the apples and not for me. So.
That is the best. I haven't heard that one. I love it. And maybe slightly true. So draw us a picture of what is happening at this USDA orchard in Western New York.
Yeah. So and I'll just preface, too, by just saying we're part of a larger program to maintain all of our agriculturally important crops. And so there's 20 sites throughout the U.S. that are really, you know, foundational to supporting agriculture and agricultural research. And especially, you know, conserving things into the future. So I'm fortunate to have the lucky assignment for apple and tart cherry. And it's really just this mission to acquire and maintain and conserve and actually document and make sure that these trees are, you know, held for future generations and are getting into the right hands so that we can have that sustainable future. And so it is impressive. I mean, it's kind of overwhelming to see 5,000 apple trees and know that each one's unique. They like to be handled differently. And because it's a living collection, you know, we have trees in the field. Other collections are and stored as seeds. So they're kind of can be secured away. Whereas we have, you know, hard winters, we have disease, we have deer damage, you know. So it's kind of it's a challenge, but it's a beautiful sight to see.
How are you being a resource to apple growers, to farmers? Can you give some examples there?
Yeah. So, especially with the boom of the cider, hard cider industry. And so people are just looking for these novel types that have the bitterness and the sharpness and then the history that they can sell with their product. And so really just one of our main focuses is just to characterize, you know, how sour is this apple? How bitter or how, you know, sweet or what is its, you know, production potential? And so we try to answer those questions so that people can kind of look through our catalogs, if you will, and our database so that they can, you know, make the right selection for themselves.
Who's to say, though, how an apple tastes and you know, how do you come up with those descriptions?
Yeah, I mean, so some of these are just kind of industry standards of, you know, how do you measure sweetness? Well, you can taste and kind of document what you taste, but also we use a Brix measurements, which is kind of a rough measurement of how sweet something might be. So apples can run up to, you know, over 20% Brix, which as a reference, honey can be up to, you know, 60 or higher percent. Mm. So some of our materials quite sweet and sourness is the same. We can just measure its pH and its acidity levels, right? Because that's what contributes to that sour factor.
Do you have any favorites that you'd like to mention?
Oh, I don't think I'm allowed to mention favorites. It's like your children, right?
I was thinking your children were apples and tart cherries, but...
No, it's what I love about my job is that everything's so diverse and you kind of, you lose that sense of what you expect from an apple. And I think that's really what holds some consumers back is that they think it should be red, it should be sweet and crunchy. And when you're willing to be flexible on texture and on flavor profiles. And so what's cool about our collection, it's really representative of worldwide apple diversity. And so you get to taste what apples would be like in Russia. And there's a French flavor to apple, you know, like they have a distinctive profile that they have selected for in their heirloom varieties. And it's pretty cool. And then you just get this broad view of what it could be. And you kind of are able to dissect each trait and appreciate it for what it is. So I guess when we taste the fruit, we're tasting potential. And that tastes a lot different than what a consumer, you know, when you buy an apple at the store, you're expecting perfection. And then anything short of what you expect or any character flaws kind of makes a kind of throws the cultivar of variety out the window.
Stakes are so high. Yes. I didn't realize just the long runway for breeding, that you have to wait 5 to 7 years before a tree produces fruit.
Yeah, it's impressive. And it's really what limits, I guess it's not limiting, but it's just what's phenomenal about apple is that it wants to be diverse. Other crops, you can inbreed, you can self-pollinate. Apple is kind of resistant to all of that. So every seed that comes from an apple is something completely unique. So, you know, Honeycrisp, all those varieties actually originated from a single seed. And so that seed takes time to mature, and, you know, sometimes up to 15 years from some of the seedlings that we have planted from some of the wild material. And so here, yeah, it's a long game. But once you get that winning variety, you can, through grafting, you can quickly get something into an orchard, and then it's typically 3 to 4 years just to fruit bearing.
You mentioned wild apples. Can you explain wild apples and how, you know, what they teach growers and plant geneticists like yourself?
Yeah, so when we eat an apple, we're typically eating just one single species, which is Malus domestica. So again, not to get scary or throw out jargon, but, you know, so each, there's a genus Malus, and there are 52 species as part of that group. And some of them are interesting, and some you'd never want to taste or would even imagine trying to eat. And that ranges from tiny crab apples to larger, still kind of bland wild apples. But these apples are just so critical for finding fascinating disease sustainability traits. You know, so we talk about disease tolerance, drought tolerance, climate tolerance, right? Like, so we have, you know, most of our collection is wild, and that's, again, not maybe ideal from a fruit quality perspective, but from incorporating some of those fascinating traits like dwarfism, so that you can, you know, grow really tightly grown or planted apple trees, you know, rather than the classic 50-foot tree. Now everything's kind of high density and moving towards, you know, more compact farms. And so, again, it's kind of anyone's guess. It's kind of a gold mine, right? Like a potential there, especially from the wild apples.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the preservation of apple varieties by the USDA. We have geneticist Ben Gutierrez, who manages the department's apple and tart cherry collections in Western New York. You can join in on apple breeding, varieties, disease, climate change in apples, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Ben, how hardy are apples to withstanding climate change and global warming? What has the research been telling you?
I think that there's tremendous potential there, but I think the challenge that production faces, particularly in the United States, is just limited, limited cultivars that are grown, limited apple varieties. And so when you have an apple variety, they become fixed in time. Right. So each apple variety has a unique composition of traits, and those are propagated through grafting. And so there's clones of these all throughout the world. Right. And they all perform more or less the same. I mean, there's some climate or environmental factors that might make them better in a certain area. And so when you think of apple diversity as a whole, it's very secure as a crop, you know, very secure in terms of climate change and other things. But it's when we get stuck on certain cultivars that maybe as climate conditions shift or winters get shorter or longer, depending on where you are, then certain things might not be well suited. And I think there's some nice examples of those, you know, throughout the world. And so, like, I know in Brazil, where they have really short winters and apple needs cold. You know, I know we don't want to think about winter coming, but our trees need time in the cold to kind of, they accumulate what's called chilling hours. So they're counting literally the hours of how cold they are so that they know when to set bloom, when it's safe to come out in the spring. And certain cultivars have a really low threshold for how many chilling hours that they need. So those are ideal in climates like South, you know, South America or in South Africa where apples are grown. Whereas in New York, and Wisconsin especially, we want long chilling hours so that we don't have trees blooming way earlier than they're safe to bloom. so that you don't get that frost damage in the kind of our volatile spring season.
How is Wisconsin's climate, do you think, for growing apples? What's your assessment?
Oh, I think Wisconsin has a wonderful history of growing apples. And again, I'm more in New York focused, not to offend any Wisconsiners.
No offense taken. We like your outside assessment.
But I think, again, if communities just like grow what they're strong at, you know, like Golden or Granny Smith is a popular apple, but in New York, the season is just too short to get like a really high quality apple. So you just shift, right? Like, again, that's what I love about apple and its culture, is that it's just kind of shifting expectations. And it's why you see so many fascinating heirlooms originating from different parts of the United States. Is, you know, this was our local apple. We don't need, you know, not everyone needs to grow the same ones. If you can focus on ones that are really well suited and adapted to your environment, that's great.
USDA geneticist Ben Gutierrez manages the Agriculture Department's apple and tart cherry collections in Western New York. Join in on heirloom apple varieties, growing methods that have been used for centuries, pest control, climate change in apples. Perhaps you want to bring up the taste of certain varieties. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Wisconsin, apples ripen from late July through October. And in this season, when we're doing so much with our apples, we explore the nation's treasure trove for apple specimens, a USDA orchard in Geneva, New York. It's more than 5,000 apple varieties, 30 acres, tissue from each kind of apple stored in a giant freezer. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. USDA geneticist Ben Gutierrez manages the apple and tart cherry collections and stays with us. Let's bring in Louie in Oconto with a question. Louie, hi, go ahead.
Yes, I am wondering if there's any heirloom apples that would grow in Wisconsin that have a unique eating apple type of flavor. My friend Scott has a chestnut crab, is what he calls it, and boy, is that a great flavor. Little different than some of these popular apples, but is there any that would do particularly well and make a great eating apple that maybe we can promote a little bit?
Louie, thank you. Ben?
Oh, that's fantastic. Chestnut crab is one of my favorites. Again, it's just this sweet little tiny russeted apple. Again, it's got kind of a scabby skin like you'd expect in a potato. Maybe I'm not selling it that well, saying scab, but it's a rustic looking apple, but its sweetness is incredible. Like, it's like a little sugar bomb. One of my personal favorites is the variety Kerr, and it's actually the cross of a crab apple called Dogol and another apple, and it's combines the sweetness and the unique aromatic flavor of the two apples, and it's pretty phenomenal. I always say it tastes a little bit like Hawaiian Punch, maybe because I'm a 90s kid and grew up on that, but it's like, it's a little bit tropical in flavor, and I think it would hold up well in cold environments.
Is there anything that may challenge the popularity of Honeycrisps?
I don't think so. I think that one's going to be here to stay. But I know a lot of the breeding programs now are using Honeycrisp as a parent. You know, so we've got Cosmic Crisp, we've got Snapdragon, we've got other apples. Again, it's because that's what the consumer shift towards crunch, and Honeycrisp has got a lot of that. Honeycrisp is, again, and I don't want to disparage any cultivars. They're all unique, right? But it's, Honeycrisp is a challenge to grow. It's got some disorders that make the fruit really challenging. Or if you don't have the right amount of calcium, or you're on the wrong rootstock, the fruit quality just doesn't match what the consumer demands. And so that creates a lot of losses for the growers. And so coming up with new varieties that maybe base or have similar traits as Honeycrisp, but you know, kind of move beyond some of those disorders, would, I think, displace it potentially. But again, I think it's such a popular variety now that it's here to stay for a while.
Do scientists have a handle on how many other apple varieties might be out there in the world?
I've heard numbers up to 5,000 and beyond. But again, that's just because every seed that comes from an apple is unique.
Mm-hmm.
And every, you know, so that's kind of the cool story of apples is that really it's only been bred as we think of traditional breeding. So plant breeding is just the process of, you know, controlling sexual reproduction in the plants and moving and selecting just the most elite of those to go on to the next generation. And so typically apple breeding was just you found a nice chance seedling. And so actually, I think Wisconsin's one of the most famous ones I found from Wisconsin was the Wolf River apple, which is this beautiful, it's gigantic. It's almost like a little mini pumpkin on the tree. But this just came from a chance seedling. So, and what's beautiful about the story is it's this man who left Quebec. Again, I guess his land ran kind of barren. And so he left Quebec to go to Wisconsin to settle there. He bought some apples. He saved some of the seeds so that he could plant them on his property. And from this property on the Wolf River came this beautiful, gigantic apple. And it's, you know, that apple is so popular even still today. But that was just by chance. That was just a one in a million find just from planting apple seeds. And so that's what's beautiful is that, again, anyone can take Honeycrisp seeds and plant up trees. And they probably won't get Honeycrisp back, but they'll get progeny that are similar or maybe worse or better. But it's kind of a gamble.
So what are your thoughts on GMOs in apples and inserting genetic material into an apple variety? What effect does that have?
Yeah. So again, at our site, we're not involved in that research in particular. But, you know, I have studied it extensively and, you know, it's got a tremendous impact to reshape the world. And again, it's a single tool, though. I think that's important to know is that it's not, you know, the panacea that's going to solve all of the agricultural challenges that we have. In apple, it's hard to say because we do have so much genetic diversity that could be used, right? So instead of modifying, you know, existing cultivars, introducing new cultivars, right? Or utilizing, you know, heirlooms or other opportunities like that. So I know it's hard to say though, because I know in some cases like papaya, the famous story of the, you know, they have a ring spot virus that there's no genetic variation for it. And that was the only solution to save papaya was to do genetic modification. And so again, it's knowing when to use it, when it's appropriate and when it's a, because it certainly is a risk for anyone wanting to make these, because I don't know what the consumer response might be.
We have USDA geneticist Ben Gutierrez, who manages the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Apple and Tart Cherry Collections in Geneva, New York. You can join in 800-642-1234, all things apple varieties. So, Ben, let's talk a little bit more about disease and pests, because Aaron from Hortonville called, couldn't stay with us, and Aaron wants to know if there are any tried and true methods to keep bugs off their apples that won't harm the honeybees.
Yeah, so we are a conventionally managed orchard, which means we're applying pesticides. And we do those, again, and a lot of research goes into the timing and when and how much, right? Like a lot of research goes into that. And I think we're getting more and more invested in preserving our native pollinators. You know, so again, and I don't really have a good answer to that. I know some of the challenges, right, is getting away from pesticides. Now you're making your crops susceptible to disease. And some of the move from, that's why we're trying to promote some of these wild species so that you can bring in that wild resistance, get a high quality apple, but also now you're minimizing the sprays or, you know, inputs that you need to do each year. It's tough. I mean, do we want apples or do we want pollinators? Because without pollinators, we can't have apples, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of this, I don't know, it's a challenge. It's a messy challenge. But we work closely with entomologists, and I know there's a tremendous amount of research that goes into that with, you know, not just the apple production, but also how to preserve, you know, beneficial insects, not just pollinators, but all of them.
Let's go to Scott in East Troy. Scott, what would you like to bring up?
Hey, good morning, guys. Yeah, so we have a crabapple tree in BLM is growing regular apples that are super sweet, and not exactly sure why it's happening. Is that something that's common? And what should we do with the seeds, if anything?
What might be going on, Ben?
Sorry, it kind of broke up a little bit. So he's got a crab apple that just tastes good.
Scott, is that it? You're growing it's a crab apple tree, you believe?
Crab apple tree. We planted about 4 years ago, but one of the limbs has regular apples on it.
Regular apples on it.
That sounds, you're lucky. That's great. So typically what happens in grafting is that just you're essentially splicing two parts. You know, you're taking a root system and you're splicing on a new apple variety, right? And so this might just simply be a mistake in production, if someone actually accidentally grafted the wrong thing onto the rootstock, a lucky mistake in your case. Hmm. And so I know some like fascinating art experiments like Tree of Life done by an artist in New York City, like where he's literally splicing, you know, 50 plus varieties onto a single tree, which again, it's when you understand grafting, it's not like out of the realm. It's not magic, right? It's just, it's determination and patience in doing that. But typically you'll find a tree just produces a single type of fruit. But you've got a lucky find.
Scott, thank you so much for calling in. And Ben, this has been fun. Thank you so much for joining us. Next time, it's tart cherries. We got to make room.
Absolutely.
Ben Gutierrez is a geneticist and the curator of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's apple and tart cherry collections based in Geneva, New York. Just ahead, as temps start to dip this time of year, the furnace kicks on. We get helpful tips and how-tos on winterizing a home and being prepared. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.